written out or I give it to you, but I had notes, so whenever you're ready. All right. I'd like to begin the interview with a foreword for those that may read this interview. I'd like to explain that I am an individual who prefers no profile and shies away from publicity which would expose my personal life and family. I also am rather reluctant to discuss the success I've had in business. However, I realize that there are many others who have contributed to my endeavors and success who deserve to know more about the people, events, and factors influencing certain decisions relating to McNeil Laboratories, which they help shape. Consequently, this information will hopefully be informative in presenting in a brief way certain facts, even though there may not be adequate background or explanation. I shall avoid using the first person in many cases, and unless I'm not attempting to indicate adequately the reasons and background regarding these decisions. But as most of the people associated with McNeil Laboratories know, it is impossible to explain some of our decisions in a simple way, inasmuch as they were group decisions, which was the our modus operandi. So that many people in committee meetings shape the final decision. Consequently, our point of view is from one whose life has been shaped by circumstances, the period, and the counsel of many who were associated with me. The experience was extraordinary, and I am most fortunate to have had the opportunities at McNeil Laboratory. While I can't create all of the circumstances which account for the factors leading to decisions, I will attempt to identify along the way many of the associates who made material contributions to the success of the organization.
Thank you. Could you tell us a little bit about your childhood? Since we most of us got our advantage from our good parents.
Well, yes, I would be glad to tell you about my early life. I was the son and the first son of a Robert Lincoln McNeil, a graduate of the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania in 1904, who entered the family business in Philadelphia, and therefore he was a Philadelphian with many generations of Scottish heritage. My mother was the daughter of New Englanders. She attended Wellesley College, class of 1912, and majored in art, but came to Philadelphia after graduation as a teacher of art at the girls' school, blank blank, which I'll fill in, soon after graduation.
The street names, such and such.
Yeah, that's the
large
one.
Large gap knew it, exactly.
My grandmother and grandfather were New Englanders. My grandmother, an old New Englander whose heritage goes back to the Mayflower, and the second boat, the Fortune, in 1621, and my grandfather, who was a congregational minister, his family also went back to those early days. He was a graduate of Dartmouth with a master's in at Harvard, and saw the light and got his doctorate at Yale.
Right. He went to Yale Divinity School?
And Yale Divinity School. He was there for a congregational minister, because in those days, Yale Divinity School was primarily a congregational oriented theology. A very probably changed on it. Well, does that give you some background?
It does. And of course, there was that puzzle I had of why you were born in Connecticut and you were born into a Philadelphia family.
Well, very easy to explain, because without air conditioning, Philadelphia was stifling, and this being my mother's first child, she went back to the Berkshire Hills in Bethel, Connecticut, and I was delivered by the family physician, Dr. George White, and a midwife at 25 South Street, Bethel, Connecticut. As you may recall, in those days, home births were the order of the day. And I might add that there are no complications, and consequently I remained at my grandmother's house for some time afterwards.
Your brother is how many years younger than you?
My brother was 2 years younger. He was born in Lankenau Hospital, Philadelphia. If you're wondering if there were others in the family, I would have had a third son. Unfortunately, he died at birth and never left the hospital.
The children that didn't make it. Well, were you kind of right in the pharmaceutical business from when you were a kid, or what? Yes, being a small company, my father indoctrinated me by asking me to come in Saturday morning after school, and I stuffed envelopes.
Which meant I put in bills to physicians who were and whatever else was necessary, and then they had enough faith in me. I took the checks, the proceeds from the day, and walked from 17th and Cambria up to Jordan, Allegheny, to the party in the Kensington Trust Company branch on the corner. That bank was taken over by several and ended up in the First Pennsylvania First Union family of neighborhood banks. I preferred the old Wachovia name from Charlotte, North Carolina.
So now you were talking to us before about your education at Germantown Academy. What was that like? Did you have a lot of science?
I was fortunate enough to have a good beginning in language and math at the Missionaries Convent School, which I attended from kindergarten through second grade. So much so that I tested well enough to skip a grade and enter Germantown Academy in the fourth grade. I might add that they were rather progressive in the sense of learning languages. I can still sing but I mention that because it held me in good stead, and my math was good. And two heads were taskmasters, but many of us responded. Going to some to Germantown Academy, some to Penn Charter, and some to Germantown Princeton. All having fairly high scholastic standing at the time. But then I progressed with the usual pattern, but it was quite evident that I was proficient in mathematics every year, and more so than languages, even though we had and literature. But I did end up number two and three in the class, and I was very proud of the fact that in the college boards I passed my French examination with enough credits from Yale, so I never took French again, and got 100 in geometry. But at school I was most interested in other activities, and played sports in the year I won three letters, but also was elected president of the class and also president of the student council, which was a separate job in essence, laying down the rules for the entire upper school. That's when I learned diplomacy.
So how did you decide to go to Yale?
My family and I agreed that I would like to attend the college outside of Philadelphia for the experience. And in discussions with my college advisor and headmaster, the headmaster participated in those discussions, I was encouraged to go to an Ivy League school, and when it came to selecting the one in particular, I would say that my grandfather, having his doctorate from Yale, and my mother being herself, who were all over Connecticut, I did not give serious consideration to the others, and I was advised that there would be no problem in my entrance. Off the record, I can give you a few
lots of I think we'll get back on it if I talk with you about the professors that
You want to ask the question again?
I'd like to hear some more about your Yale College days. I know you went to Sheffield Science School, which was a separate entity from the arts
department. Yes, it was. But freshman year, we were all together, and we all took more or less the same course. And but then we elected to go in different directions. And we then, one decided whether they wanted to go into science. And science and engineering were over in Sheffield School. And the academic group, ACK as we called it, had the literature, art, language, and so forth, more or less the pure subjects of, I shouldn't say pure, but I'll change that later. But then, for those of us that wanted to go to Sheffield School, we made that declaration, and we actually lived over in Sheffield. Mm-hmm. Which was over centered around Grove Street and went on up to the laboratory. And so therefore while we were able to take electives over in ACK, we did have practically all of the courses delivered by Sheffield faculty. For example, Loomis Havermeyer, who was the assistant dean, gave a course in applied economic science that would have been equivalent to an ACK course in economics, given by someone else over in the academics, over in ACK as they call it.
So that was actually a period of great building, physical building at the when you were there.
Yes, it was an extraordinary period because through the generosity of Herkness, we had these residential colleges. And during my years at Yale, the administration required that all members of the class be a member of a college. I was not my sophomore year. I was a member of one of three fraternities that survived the administration's demand that there not be fraternities. But we were strong enough so that I was a member of St. Elmo. But at the same time, I became a member of Timothy Dwight College my senior year, which had just opened. But the academic group were all members of, in my year, they were all members of a residential college, and they were not allowed to live off campus or in the fraternity house without the president's permission. I'll change that. And I get it. It's the permission to live off campus.
It's about the same time as Wilson was doing the same sort of thing in Princeton.
Yes. I would say that Yale's program was very successful because they had extraordinary masters of the college who had their own program in arts and science and informal talks after dinner, but also sports teams. There was a college lead in every sport. And this is because Yale drew a very active group. 175 went out for freshman football.
Well, your big sport was basketball?
Yes, I got my letters in freshman football, but I played basketball and a little baseball enough to get junior varsity letter my sophomore year. But then basketball was played in the new gymnasium on campus, and which was built for, well, no, it was blank, and I'll fill that in easily. But it was developed also for the swimming team, which then had set an all-time collegiate record for the number of continuous dual meets. And during my years, it continued without having lost a meet under a Bob Kibbert, who was the coach and later became an Olympic coach.
Right. This is, I think it's called the Kibbert Memorial Swimming Pool.
For that week? Yeah. But it had also many other innovations to encourage sport, exercise rooms, and so forth, which today we think are just something of the period. They had an advanced program then.
Some of the laboratories were being built then, too, I think.
Yes. Well, my chemistry laboratory, Stirling Lab, had been built. It's been added on to recently. The Klein Biology Lab has been was built afterwards. Physics was in an old building, but I believe they've added on to that. But to go on with my education, I had organic chemistry with a Robert Coghill, C-O-G, for the record. Now, because I'll be talking about Coghill, C-O-W. But you can scratch all some of this out there. Get to the fire. But then, as we then as I went on, I went into a special biology class, which intrigued me because we worked from journals as well as books. It was that advanced. And it soon became evident to me that rather than straight chemistry, I hope the wall won't come down, that my fort was going to be biochemistry or biology. And with that in mind, I headed toward physiological chemistry and bacteriology, which had to be taken over in medical school, 333 Senior Street. And two of us qualified for what was the graduate program in the medical school in this field. The program was headed by a George Coghill, C-O-W. George was editor of the Journal of Nutrition, one of the eminent research men and scientists of the day, who determined man's requirement of vitamin B1 8 or 9 years before thiamine was synthesized and recognized as a pure entity. He did it with his graduate students doing the work, so you can appreciate the level. At the time, the head of pharmacology was Dr. Barber, and he had two young Turks, Goodman and Gilman, teaching pharmacology, pharmacodynamics, and pharmacokinetics. And they were extraordinary teachers and lecturers, and left Yale soon afterwards to become full professors, and together they wrote Goodman and Gilman, which became the Bible for the Food and Drug Administration in the administration of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938.
You were actually taught with those two guys? Did you take classes with Goodman and Gilman?
I didn't take classes. I was quite aware of them because some of my classmates had entered the medical school in advance, and I did do a little bit of auditing and attended their anatomy class where they were working on one half of an individual, they counted, you couldn't take your fingers from, they counted the number there, and you put them back if you had it in his pocket. But along with her, my lab instructor was Ray White, who had just gotten his doctorate at Michigan, came to Yale because of his reputation, and in a few years went to California and was the co-discoverer of ACTH, the adrenal corticotropic hormone, which led to all of the steroid therapy and the development of the steroid drugs. He made a tremendous contribution to pharmaceutical chemistry. But that was the caliber of the group at Yale. I was most fortunate to have them as my preceptor.
So when you graduated from Yale, what did you do?
Well, about that time, I had a message from home. I was leaning toward an MD degree, the other undergraduate did go into medicine. I was leaning toward a degree in medicine, but my father's health was poor, the company was small, there was great concern over the future, and I was induced to change my plans to come into the family company, which at that point had become Yale Laboratories. When my grandfather died, the firm of Robert McNeil was dissolved, and in 1933 the organization became Yale Laboratories. So with that in mind, and with the request that I devote time to the trend of the business, and great concern over possible passage of the Federal Food and Cosmetic Act and the Real Relief Act, which related to advertising, I was persuaded and heeded the word of the request of my father, and came, of course, where I would get exposure to pharmacy by enrolling in the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy. I enrolled in their four-year course, and with the consent of the administration, asked if I could pass the courses for freshmen and junior at the same time, and senior, that I would get a full degree. In other words, I had to pass every course. This was a state requirement, Pennsylvania state requirement. So I, in essence, I carried a Remington reference book about this thick, because when I went into junior classes, I had to know something that went on freshman year, many times it wasn't clear, but I doubled up in my courses and was able to accelerate that way and to get a degree. Actually, I got a degree with distinction and winning Williamson Scholarship because of my high marks.
So you did 4 years and 2 years.
Yeah. Yes. And then I realized from my Yale background that I had to have pharmacology. So the second year, I went to Temple and enrolled in their graduate pharmacy school under a James Munch for pharmacology. But because the subject wasn't, let's say, as well known as a path, there were only three of us. And for that reason, I was able, with outside reading, to keep up with work in the classroom, even though I was a little short on time often because of conflict between classes at one institution and the time at the other.
So we used to
fight, but she's got to look at it. You
Need a market, I need for a little while. We'll open, I'll have to make it.